Coming up on Tech Nation, how we came to question climate change, to even question the science. What's it all about? Nathaniel Rich, the author of Losing Earth, A Recent History, will explain. It's not about the science. It's about money and power and politics and unapologetically the bottom line. Then Tech Nation chief correspondent Daniel Kraft talks about what we probably all thought was coming. The age of the selfie has now been supplanted by something new. We're now commencing on the age of the medical selfie. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
If you've been on airplanes lately, you know that the airline industry is going through a bit of a wireless and communications transition, which is understandable. The technology is changing all the time, and their services must as well. Not so long ago, it was an industry breakthrough to be able to show movies on long flights. You could just get one in from San Francisco to Chicago if they started it right away. Like kids at camp, there was a large screen in each cabin. And just before, flight attendants would go down the aisle distributing bulky headsets. Unlike today, where everyone pretty much brings their own. The airlines tinkered with the headsets were free. No, they're $4. No, what's your class of service? And even then, these were the days when you wouldn't use a credit card on board an airplane. There was only cash, and the bursar really was the bursar. Change was frequently asked for over the announcement system. But the truly unfortunate part of the technology? When the captain or attendants came on to make an announcement, the movie didn't stop playing, but the audio was preempted. I remember watching one Oscar contender when the pilot came on just as the critical scene was playing out. Passengers throughout the plane threw their arms up and loudly voiced some version of, "What?" They couldn't rewind, so that was that. The good news was that the pilot wasn't watching along with us, so he didn't know that this was not the time to tell us to look out the left side of the airplane. And then the large screen transitioned to individual screen, and now some airlines ask you to connect your tablet or phone to watch any of a big selection of video, be it movies or television, and you can even connect with the internet at various price points, some of which are steep indeed. All of this stopped the rush to the restroom at the end of the movie, and something else, the constant pushing of the attendant call button. Passengers are engaged in all kinds of activities, from books, whether digital or on paper, to videos, to games, to you name it. Look down and there's an electric plug by your seat. We're all mesmerized by our personal technology. Until it doesn't work. I flew coast to coast on a fully packed plane recently that sat on the runway for an hour before taking off. Gate to gate, we were looking at about 7 hours in our seats. And what happened? The wireless didn't work. And that meant no movies, no TV, no working on your email, no nothing. The person sitting beside me peeked between the seats to read the large text format of the person in front of us, who had what looked to be a pretty racy novel on her big tablet. Just like the old days, we were suddenly getting free snacks, and while the attendants kept telling us that the Wi-Fi worked, we kept telling them that it didn't. Finally, the public announcement came on with an apology, and the airline's website, where we could get a choice of reward for this horrible experience. It turned out we got our choice of $75 to be applied to a future flight or nearly 4,000 frequent flyer miles. Not a bad choice when you think about it, but you still have to feel for the flight attendants. They didn't have a second to themselves. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Nathaniel Rich about how we developed the perception that the science around climate change was based on questionable science. It didn't have anything to do with science at all. Then Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the natural extension to the selfie. You can figure it out. It's the medical selfie. When I first saw Nathaniel Rich's book, Losing Earth, A Recent History, I thought, it's doomed. Another climate change book, another scientist pleading for people to listen. And then I realized Nathaniel Rich is not a scientist.
I am decidedly not a scientist. Yeah, I topped out at, I think, AP Physics maybe in high school.
Ooh, still impressive.
Yeah, well, impressive. I didn't do very well, I should say. No, I'm a novelist and I write narrative nonfiction as well. And I was struck by the fact that nobody had really taken that approach to this subject, which I think is the great subject of our time. And you're right, it tends to be written about in a very narrow way. You know, the sort of scientific story, the political story, sometimes the economic story, but it's rare that we anyone sort of examines the human story, and that's where I felt I could make a contribution.
You opened the book, in fact, with a simple sentence. Nearly everything we understand about global warming was understood in 1979. I mean, we're talking over 40 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great climate scientist in Stanford, Ken Caldera, who told me that every semester he starts off his graduate classes with this trick question, basically, which is to say he asks his students to identify any developments in the fundamental science of climate change since 1979. And of course, nobody can do it because there haven't been any fundamental
developments. Keep Googling. Maybe you'll find it.
You know? Well, there's been more data. There's more specificity. And, you know, the predictions are sort of less hazy and when we talk about regional effects and things like that. But no, the basic science has been agreed upon since 1979. And I should say that the very fundamental science, essentially the idea that CO2 is a greenhouse gas and the more we burn fossil fuels, the more CO2 is in the atmosphere and the more that will heat up the planet, that's been understood since the 19th century.
And that's been happening through the Industrial Revolution. We've had two centuries of solid burning of fossil fuel, which did not exist previously.
Right. And not only has it been consistent, but it's been rapidly accelerating over those centuries to the point where there's been more carbon dioxide contributed to the atmosphere since 1989, which is when the action in my book ends, than in all of civilization before that.
Now, following on that initial sentence, shortly thereafter, you write perhaps an even more important sentence, and within it a very important phrase. You say, today, almost 9 out of 10 Americans do not know that scientists agree well beyond the threshold of consensus. There's the important one. Well beyond consensus, it's not open for question. Human beings have altered the global climate through indiscriminate burning of fossil fuels. It's not a question of, well, the data looks pretty good and it's a theory. We know it. It's proven.
Yeah, we've known it for 40 years, and there's been extremely solid consensus. And that's really why I felt that I didn't want to waste time engaging in that old debate about, you know.
Debate's over.
The science is real. Yeah, I felt that has been done ad infinitum. And at this point, if you continue to try to have that conversation with people who are, you know, intent on having it in bad faith, you're just playing into the game. And so just as the science was settled back then, I also felt that it was not worth dwelling on it beyond establishing the basic facts. And in fact, the story is what happens after the science is settled, 1979, when you have the first efforts to try to solve the problem. And that's what Losing Earth is. It's the story of essentially the birth of climate activism.
So let's get into the money, the power, human frailty, the oh-so-human endeavor to do the right things individually and collectively. And so let's start where you start. Let's start with Rafe Pomerantz.
Yeah, Rafe Pomerantz is just a fascinating, brilliant, charismatic, pretty hilarious guy. He was about 32. He had been working for his whole 20s on Clean Air Act amendments in the 1970s that were passed in 77. He was an air guy and an activist who worked at Friends of the Earth. And he was essentially in the position that I think all of us are in to some extent, or find ourselves at some point when we come to terms with the size of the problem, which is that he comes across the issue in a government, obscure government report that he's just reading in his office.
And let's be clear, historians read text like scientists do, you know, one line at a time, one context, this reference is this, what's the thing, do I understand where I am? I mean, I think a lot of scientists don't know that about historians, and historians don't know that about scientists, but we're talking about really careful reading these huge government reports. And this little paragraph jumps out at him.
Yeah, and he is trained as a historian. He went to Cornell, and he's, page 60-something of this government pamphlet, it mentions that human beings burning fossil fuels will warm the planet and lead to these devastating cataclysmic consequences. And he's confused because he figures that, you know, surely if somebody, if this was real, someone would have told him as one of the leading sort of policy wonks on Capitol
Hill. Did they bury the lead, as we say?
Right, exactly. And so he assumes he must be confused. He's not a scientist, he's sure. But then a couple days later, he reads an interview with a very prominent scientist, Gordon MacDonald, who's essentially the chief scientist for the CIA at the time. And MacDonald's become very concerned about the issue. And Pomerantz basically responds as I think any of us would respond, or as you see people, you know, the scientists in the first scene of the disaster movies respond when they see the alien entering the alien ship entering the stratosphere, which is to say, gee, we better tell some people about this. And surely once some powerful folks understand what's going on, they will act.
Whoops.
Yeah. And so they
just like in the books, just like in the movies.
Just like in the movies. Yeah. You run to sort of central command. And that's basically what he does. And he goes on this sort of amusing tour of Capitol Hill with Gordon MacDonald. He's a draft dodger. MacDonald is essentially the brains of the military industrial complex. They're both really concerned about this problem. And they go knocking on the door of every powerful person in D.C. and explaining the situation. MacDonald does a kind of lecture on the history of the science, and they work their way up to the president's, Jimmy Carter's own science advisor, Frank Press, another very distinguished older scientist, and explain the situation to him and assume that he will surely take action. And he does, sort of, which is to say he does what I guess is considered action within the government, but I think the rest of us would consider inaction, which is he asks for a bunch of scientists to do another report. And that comes back. That's the Charney report. It validates everything that MacDonald and Pomerantz had said. And again, it seems like they're on the verge of action, and yet Carter is shortly out of office and Reagan comes in.
At one point, you recount Rafe Pomerantz speaking to a young Al Gore and saying, you know, don't rely on the scientists. You know, it's not their job. The politicians have to do it. And politicians have many different backgrounds. You don't always get a prime minister like Margaret Thatcher, who studied chemistry at Oxford. She got it. We sort of see that woven throughout the book. Wherever we're going, you know, is this a business person with what kind of a background do you have? how they're able to grasp, or as we used to say, grok the story, really depends a lot, not just on the power, the ability that what they have, but what their background is.
Yeah, and you mentioned Al Gore. I mean, Gore had this serendipitous experience of having taken an undergraduate class at Harvard with Roger Revelle, who the same group of scientists as Frank Press and Gordon MacDonald, advisor to presidents, and he was the first really prominent scientist to bring national attention to global warming, prospect of global warming, way back in the 1950s. And he had published a major paper on the subject, 56, 57. And Gore happened to take one of his classes, and Revelle explained the science in the class. And Gore was frightened and had the same response basically that Pomerantz had, which is to say, you know, Good
holy
heavens!
Moly,
holy moly!
It's real.
Right?
It's real.
Someone better figure this out. And no one had by the time he became a junior congressman from Tennessee. And so Gore thought, well, surely if we get Revelle, my old teacher, to come and explain to Congress what he explained to me, this body will have no choice but to act. And of course, he holds that hearing, 1980, and very, very few congressmen are present. No, almost nobody else is present, and it passes unnoticed, just about. But that's the beginning of a process that Ralph Pomerantz is very much behind as well, to try to essentially grab the lapels of anybody who in power, ultimately, then of the public. And force them to understand what was happening and what had to be done.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Nathaniel Rich. You may know him from his work in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, or the New York Review of Books, or from his novels, most recently King Zeno. He's best known around these parts for his 2005 San Francisco Noir, the city in film noir from 1940 until the present. Formerly the fiction editor at the Paris Review, his latest book is Losing Earth, A Recent History. Bouncing around here a bit through these stories, which are both individual yet interwoven, it's not just about science. I mean, engineers study science, and yet some engineers either rejected it or thought technology could outpace it, outrun what we were seeing here. And here's a familiar name, John Sununu, White House Chief of Staff under the first President Bush. He had a PhD in mechanical engineering from MIT. He thought the science was questionable.
Yeah, Sununu is a fascinating case. I mean, you're right. There are people in the 80s, starting in sort of around 82 and 83, once you have a major comprehensive government report that year called Change in Climate, when even Roger Revelle, you know, concludes, yes, this is very serious, but, you know, we don't need to go out of our way to address it this minute, and which has a fatal effect on the momentum. But by the end of the decade, after a number of sort of high-profile events and James Hansen testifying before Congress and the success of the Ozone Treaty, there is a clear path towards what is seen at the time as a global solution, a binding international treaty to reduce carbon emissions. And that's when John Sununu enters the stage, and he's a PhD in engineering, and he's in some ways sort of patient zero of the climate denialism, because he is the first prominent person to say, well, hold on. I don't necessarily believe that the science is
and
settled.
Major credentials.
Yeah. I mean, he's a PhD. He considers himself an old engineer, even though at that point he'd been governor of New Hampshire for two terms and was then chief of staff for George H.W. Bush, who he was credited with having delivered the candidacy in New Hampshire after Bush had lost in Iowa. In the primary, Sununu sort of used his political machine to help elect Bush. He was rewarded with this position of enormous power within the administration.
And he has an MIT.
MIT professor.
Set of degrees.
Yeah.
And professor.
Yeah,
yeah.
And a professor about public policy and science. And so he both has a skepticism about the science based on his own training in engineering, which is, you know, a different discipline than the kind of work that James Hansen, the NASA scientist, and others are doing at the time around global warming. But he has this scientific skepticism, and it's powered by kind of ideological skepticism. He has this conspiratorial theory about leftist forces, sort of this cabal of mysterious leftist forces that use over the decades have used scientific theory to advance what he calls an anti-growth policy. And so he gave as an example, the population scare, population bomb. In the 70s.
That'd be the Paul Ehrlich discussions at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he feels that climate change is part of this history. And so he, it's a bit contorted. I find the thinking a bit contorted. But of course, it's a version of what now has become mainstream ideology within the Republican Party. But at the time, there was no one else saying these things. So he had to basically go around the Bush administration and explain what he was talking about, both the science that it was unsettled and this sort of nefarious theory about how these forces were using it and wanted to destroy American growth. And so you have this odd turn of events in the first year of the George H.W. Bush administration where though Bush has spoken very strongly about the need for a treaty and the need to solve global warming, he campaigned on it. And the head of his EPA, William Riley, has also very strongly in favor of this path. Sununu's not, and there's a kind of dogfight within the White House, and they go back and forth. And Bush's own public comments sort of change depending on whether Riley or Sununu wrote his last speech, basically on the subject. And so he's all over the map. And at one point, Sununu and Riley, like two squabbling siblings, go to the president and say, "We disagree. You know, what should we do?" And Bush says essentially, "Well, you guys figure it out for yourselves and tell me what you know. I trust you can figure it out for yourselves and tell me what you decide." He wasn't really engaged in a meaningful way. He didn't really understand the science, is my sense from the reporting. And Sununu, as the more powerful person in the administration, was ultimately able to win, or at least defeat any serious commitment by the United States to an agreement. And in retrospect, that moment where the U.S. drops out of any kind of binding treaty to reduce carbon emissions is the closest that we've come since to a major global solution on the subject.
The big bang of climate denial.
Yeah, right.
Right there, and right in front of you. Well, as it turns out, you know, yours is not an explanation of the science by the scientist, and you're trying to shake the reader into action here. But it's rather a story or a series of interwoven stories about humans. And it's a form, as I understand it, of historical narrative. And for scientists and engineers, and actually everyone, they need to know what's true and what did you make up and how did you get it into story form. Sometimes you have to lose or color. Tell us how that worked for you.
Oh, well, it's all true.
It's all true.
It's all true.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's nonfiction.
Even though he's known for being a novelist, it's all true.
It's all true. In fact, you know, an earlier version of the piece was published in the New York Times Magazine. And yeah, we had 8 fact checkers working on it. And not only that, but the level of rigor for this piece in the book was higher than I think your typical historical narrative, because it had to appear in the Times first. And so what I mean by that is not to call most writers of popular histories liars, but I did discover upon, you know, as I was working on the book, I tried to see how other writers handled difficulties, you know, with research. And I realized that actually in this genre, you know, if you're reading a popular history of you know, John Adams or the you know, the some old war, you realize that writers often do take certain liberties, extrapolations, and I couldn't do that because I was writing it for the Times Magazine. I didn't want to do that because I didn't feel like there was any
there's no need
to. Yeah, but what it meant essentially is that if someone told me, you know, if Rafe Pomerantz said to me, you know, I remember standing up at that meeting and, you know, pounding the table and saying, we have to act now. Darn it. It wasn't enough for him just to say, that's how I remember it. I had to interview everyone else who was alive, who was in that room, and see if they also remembered it. And if no one else remembered it, even if they said, oh, yeah, that sounds like something Rafe would have said, that wasn't good enough for the Times fact checker. So it was that level of rigor. And so that just meant, which I was grateful for, but it just meant I had to, it took an enormous amount of time because people's memories aren't good and finding documentation is just, you know, takes a long
time. Good luck with that.
Yeah, I have a newfound respect for historians. But no, it just meant I had to do a ton of work and then had to figure out how to reconstruct it in a narrative form.
So here we have the big New York Times and we have 8 fact checkers and you're just trying to do your work here. Good luck with that.
Yeah, no, it was something else. Yeah.
Well, while the Sununu episode we described may be the big bang of the climate deniers, throughout this period, they expanded massively. Give us sort of a blueprint of what that looks like.
Yeah, well, I learned in my reporting for the first time how exactly that strategy formed within the industry. I had, you know, people who are writing about this issue now or scientists, you know, you can't get someone from the industry to talk to a reporter, certainly not a New York Times reporter. But my sources, for the most part, are out of the industry now because this is a period 30 years ago. They're retired. Some perversely have moved on to careers in like green consulting. That's true of one of my sources from the American Petroleum Institute. And so they were very frank and honest with me, and they had nothing to hide from their perspective. And so what happens is James Hansen gives this major testimony in 1988 during the summer, the hottest summer on record, before Al Gore's Senate committee. And he says, you know, it's time to stop waffling. Global warming is here. It's no longer a theory. We can see hard evidence of it in the temperature records. And it becomes a national story overnight. There's a huge amount of national concern. And at the highest levels of American Petroleum Institute and Exxon, biggest oil and gas company then as now, there are conversations about what are we going to do about this? Because it seemed inevitable that some kind of policy was going to happen. George Bush was stumping about it even. And so there are a couple of study groups that form, one at API, one at Exxon, and they both reach basically the same conclusions.
I've been speaking with Nathaniel Rich, the author of Losing Earth, A Recent History. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation are available at iTunes, NPR One, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the medical selfie. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Nathaniel Rich. You may know him from his reporting in the New York Times Magazine and The Atlantic, or for his novels, most recently King Zeno. Today we're talking about his latest book, Losing Earth, A Recent History, which tells the story of the resistance to the idea of climate change, specifically climate disruption due to the burning of fossil fuels, not by a small group of scientists who didn't believe the science, but rather as a strategy introduced by big oil. To be clear, Nathaniel's not a scientist, but you don't have to know any science to understand this story. Now back to our interview.
At the highest levels of American Petroleum Institute and Exxon, biggest oil and gas company then as now, there are conversations about what are we going to do about this? So there are a couple of study groups that form, one at API, one at Exxon, and they both reach basically the same conclusions, which are to say we need to engage politically with this. We need to be part of any conversation about policy. We need to make sure that we emphasize any uncertainty in the science where it exists, which is not to say, we need to say that the science is uncertain, which would happen later, but we need to say, where there are uncertainties around the margins, we need to emphasize that. We need to make sure that no policy goes beyond what's warranted by the science. Again, this is all
contain, make sure it's
a response. Yeah. And sort of the one where they go a little bit further is they say we will not endorse any policy that will affect the bottom line. So this is the beginning of it. And it's not really different from what they do about it with any other environmental or health issue, of which they have, hundreds at any given time. But as sort of a side project, part of this, the American Petroleum Institute has their PR office start to do a few little things when they're not busy with more important matters. And one of those things, they talk to congressmen, they start to sort of lobby a little bit. And then they find some scientists. At first, it's about three or four guys, literally, who they think they can be counted on and have some skepticism about the science. And they're close with the industry, and they start to even pay some of them $2,000 each, I learned in my reporting, to write op-eds for publications. And all of a sudden, you start to see, and this is now 1989, these names, these three or four guys, popping up in articles and national publications and changing the way the story is covered. Instead of it being a story of sort of panic and how to respond, it's now there are now two sides, and so it plays right into this fetish we have in sort of American journalism about, well, we have to have both sides of the story, and you start to see cover articles in national publications saying maybe this is overblown, maybe this isn't so bad after all,
or at the end of a covering this and they say but of course there is another side to this which we're not going to talk about today, but we will mention, and it's like, no, there isn't.
Well, yeah, and even at the time it seemed a little peculiar. I think the journal Science is an esteemed journal that year, 89, published a story saying, what's up with these guys? There's literally four to however many hundreds are
thousands.
Now thousands, but I think 89 there were only so many people who were working on it, and this is a bizarre phenomenon. But so essentially, this effort by API's comms shop, which was two ex newspaper men who had been recruited to run that office, had so much success that's ultimately where the effort go. It turned into a PR effort, and this propaganda effort and disinformation campaign grew and grew sort of more brazenly over the years. They kept pushing it until you get into this delirium of climate denialism, which we're still suffocated by to this day.
Well, together, big oil is represented by the American Petroleum Institute. Individual companies can do whatever they like. What do the individual companies do? Do we know?
Well, at first they all went along with this. The Global Climate Coalition was this sort of fake organization that was started by API, and it was joined by just about all of the major oil and gas companies. And this comms effort was run if you got the press releases from them, it would say Global Climate Coalition, not American Petroleum Institute. And it was not until really the end of the 90s, once they'd really gotten pretty far out into denialism after around the time of the Kyoto IPCC meeting, where API spent an enormous amount of money to thwart any possibility of a U.S. Agreement, that a couple of companies, like I remember BP, for instance, start to become a little embarrassed by this kind of rhetoric. I mean, they've known full well the whole time that the science is real. And, you know, this internal scientists within the industry are never really questioning it. So you start to see a couple defections then, but it doesn't really change the conversation. And it's not like BP becomes a sort of savior of, you know, the environmental movement. They continue with their operations as ever. But that's the first kind of sense of turning away from this, that this has gotten a little bit too crazy. And those defections continued some, you know, and until you have finally now, you know, there's none of the major oil and gas companies say these things anymore publicly. Doesn't mean they're good, you know, corporate citizens, but if you watch a national spot for Exxon, you'd think they were, you know, an algae company and green energy company.
Sunshining.
And clean solutions, you know, all of that. But we have this bizarre situation now where the Republican Party is further to the right in their messaging than the industry itself. We now have denialism has become a central tenet to Republicanism. And so you have this bizarre thing where it's the only major, you know, national party in the world that endorses these views, views that even oil and gas industry itself would be ashamed to take up in a public forum.
And the U.S. is a major producer of these burning fossil fuels. I mean, we're talking about a major contribution to the situation as it exists today.
Yeah, we were number one back in the 80s, and now China is ahead of us. But it's also further along the path towards in green technology and use of renewables.
Now, let's be clear. Alongside this, we have the United Nations. We have the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. How do they play in? What are those jokers doing?
Yeah, you know? a title about that gives you a good sense of the quality of the writing of the reports. You know, they get on the issue in the mid. It's formed in the mid 80s, late 80s, after the UN through the WMO has helped to bring into being the ozone agreement, the Montreal Protocol. And it's believed that that will be the template for a CO2 agreement. And so they start working in earnest 87, 88 on a similar type of treaty. And that's this binding emissions framework. And they continue to work, of course, to this day, but these resolutions and these treaties that come out are sort of been increasingly less powerful as the years have gone on. Until you get to Paris, which is voluntary, non-binding. You know, each country sets its own benchmarks, and in fact, within the couple of years since ratification, most countries are not coming close to hitting those benchmarks. So I think the UN's done, you know, the IPCC has done what it can do. But if you don't have countries that are, especially the most powerful countries, are not interested in a real solution, then it's not going to get very far.
I should probably say that, you know, one of my orientations here is I worked so hard for so many years to be so respectful for everyone's opinion. And then when I finally read how the whole thing came about, it was like, wait a minute, I got taken like everybody else. And here I am in the media trying to explain science. I really think that some of these terms the public can only keep in its mind for some number of years, and it's kind of old news.
Well, I think the terms are deeply inadequate as well. One of the reasons I became interested in writing about this subject is that I felt the language that we use is itself a lie. I mean, or at the very best, misleading. You have, you know, it was the CO2 problem originally, which doesn't seem like much of a problem since we all exhale CO2 with every breath. The greenhouse effect, which is not even descriptive, really, of the nature of the problem. Global warming and climate change, you know, of course, our concern is not for the globe or for the climate, but for human civilization. And we still haven't come, and I feel inadequate as a writer that I've failed myself to come up with a better, more descriptive term, even climate crisis, which is now sort of more in vogue.
I vote for your term, planetary asphyxiation.
Yes.
Like, that's wow, you got my attention.
Well, it's really civilizational asphyxiation, I guess, would be even more descriptive. That doesn't really roll off the tongue. But no, I think that's a big problem. But I also think it's the basic science, all you have to know is that the more we burn fossil fuels, the more CO2 goes in the atmosphere and the warmer it's going to get. And I feel like that is the simple background that you hope everyone can understand or be communicated. And if people then have questions about, well, why is it, you know, colder than normal on this given day in this given city, then you can go and explain that. But I think that one of the big triumphs of denialism has been to hold the conversation at this very basic sort of square one locus, which is what's the science? Is the science real? What's, you know, and so even as it's sort of so disinformation and ignorance and all the rest, politicization, it's also managed to keep us from talking about some really important policy issues that we're going to have to figure out and over which, you know, reasonable people might disagree. For instance, you know, what do we do about, you know, out of work coal miners, say? What do we do, if anything? What's the best form of a carbon tax or carbon pricing? Where should the proceeds from a tax go? What exactly should we do about bringing, say, nuclear technology to the developing world or other technologies to help developing countries modernize or escape crushing poverty without having them resort to huge, you know, increases in coal combustion, things like that. So those are all, you know, they're different. You could imagine in like a functioning democracy a sort of right-left divides on some of those issues. But we've never progressed that far where we're still on the science. And so that's why I feel like the scientific conversation is a bit of a red herring.
Also, what you were talking about are societal challenges. I think part of your point in the book is about a moral decision personally. Even if you're in the depth of this and say, okay, we're part of this is the policy and we're trying to – it's like – everybody literally has to look at themselves at this point.
Yeah, I think it's the only honest way of understanding the issue that you have these extraordinary, almost comic book level villains, you know, at Exxon and API and so on. And it's not to let any of them off the hook, but I think we also have to acknowledge that we are all contributing to this problem, whether we like it or not. You know, that even a homeless American contributes more, it's responsible for a larger carbon footprint than the average person in the world, average global citizen. And so I think you do have to understand this issue as a moral issue, that this is an issue that affects our future and also worsens every form of injustice and inequality just about that we have in our society. It victimizes the people who are already victimized by our society. And so I think one has to understand it as a moral question. And to do so means we have to understand the degree to which we're all responsible, not only for contributing to it, but for trying to do something about it. And I think that's really the reason one of the main reasons I wanted to write the kind of story that I wrote, a story about human beings, because I feel like some of these moral questions just have not been addressed in the literature on the subject. And what was striking to me about the stories of people like Ralph Pomerantz or James Hansen during the decade I wrote about was that they were grappling with these questions on a very personal, intimate level. You know, way back in the early 1980s, when Ralph Pomerantz discovers the problem, his wife is 7 months pregnant, and he starts to wonder whether it's right to be having children. I think this is a kind of conversation that, one hears more and more often. And my wife is currently 7 months pregnant. It's a conversation that we've had. And I think, of course, people will have it increasingly in the years and decades ahead. But, he was grappling with it back at the beginning. And I think through his story and stories of people like him, I think there's a way for us to try to understand these issues a little bit better ourselves. And I think that's a place where writing can make a contribution and literature on the subject can make a contribution.
Well, I usually have this conversation right at the beginning of an interview. I think it's now important to have it at the end. Just sum up for us. What does science say is going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years if nothing changes?
If nothing changes, things will get progressively bad. I mean, sea level rise, huge political destabilization all over the world, hundreds of millions of climate refugees.
Already today, the Red Cross says that there are more climate refugees than violence refugees.
Right. Yes, and I think the way that certain food crises, water shortages, and I think the way that people in the wealthiest parts of the world will feel the issue expressed most strongly soonest is in war. I mean, I think what we're talking about, when you have tens of millions of people moving, say, from Africa into Europe, from South America into North America, from the coasts of Southeast Asia inland, you have a huge amount of stress on just about every kind of political system and welfare system that exists, and all of these sort of delicate regional truces we have now will be really put to the test, and in some of these places where the climate effects will be most serious, you have nuclear states, and so there's an enormous amount of risk. It's why I think the State Department has refused Trump and others in his administration's efforts to try to get them to stop talking about this, because they see this as one of the major geopolitical danger in the years ahead.
Well, Nathaniel, I want to apologize for thinking your book was doomed in the beginning. I think it's anything but doomed. And it's a very interesting example about how you can talk about complex science, complex issues, through the stories of people involved in it over the years. You can actually bring it together through the people, not through the organizations, not through the official reports. And it's a good example of that. So I hope you'll come back and see us again.
Thanks for having me.
My guest today is Nathaniel Rich. His most recent novel is King Zeno, and his latest book is Losing Earth, A Recent History. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Do you remember selfie sticks? Yes, some are still out there. Those collapsible sticks which hold your smartphone so you can take a picture of yourself. But more popular indeed are just plain old selfies, which people post on Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, and the like, or even print out and frame for their desk, the old-fashioned way. But here's a new idea. Maybe we'll get in the habit of medical selfies. That's right. With all this new technology, we can pretty much check out our own health and the health of our families with what would be available to any of us. TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft explains medical selfies.
Well, we're in this age now of digital data. We have our exponential technologies in our pocket. Our smartphones are really supercomputers. And now the cameras, as you've noticed, on our mobile devices have really accelerated. I don't even carry my LSR around anymore.
Your what?
My big old clunky camera.
Your single lens reflex.
Exactly. I carry my, you know, my mobile phone, which does incredible portraiture and beyond, and is adding on all sorts of video capabilities as well. So the idea of a medical selfie is now taking a picture of you can give you a clue into your health, a classic physician type element. We train to look at a patient, so look at them, and you can look at the whites of someone's eyes. If their eyes turning a bit yellow, well, maybe it's a sign of some early liver failure. The bilirubin levels are high. Now you can imagine your Facebook photos might screen your face for early yellowing and give you a little ding. You can see signs of stroke or signs as people compare one photo to another that might be indicative of a medical problem. But more on the detail side, let's take a very common medical issue. Let's say a urinary tract infection.
Happens a lot.
A UTI. And, you know, classically we'll want the patient to bring in some urine to the lab and look for bacteria, culture it. We often do what's called a simple urinalysis. And many of you have seen a little dipstick and you compare the colors and they might change if there's blood or protein or evidence of nitrates from bacteria. And that's often done by hand or even very spectrophotometers that will measure that very specifically in a lab. Now, we've seen several companies emerge where you can dip your urine dipstick, use the camera, which has now high resolution and very good color metrics, and take a picture of that dipstick, often with some standard colors next to it, and do the urinalysis automatically. And now upload that data to the cloud and directly to your physician, who then might prescribe you an antibiotic, for example. There's a company out of Israel called Healthy.io that now has a product called Dip.io that is in drugstores in the United Kingdom, where you can go in and down do this at home. It's approved there. And so it's one market for, let's say, doing basic urinalysis if you have a potential infection. Pregnant women, for example, often check their urine. But another great example is diabetic patients where their kidneys might be impacted by diabetes. So what this company specifically is doing is measuring protein using this approach and finding diabetes patients with early signs of kidney damage. So then the healthcare system, in this case the NHS, the National Health Service, is able to intervene early and hopefully prevent renal failure and folks ending up on dialysis and potentially even dying. So something as simple as a medical selfie there for your analysis can be effective. Or your camera might take a picture of a wound. Let's say you have a surgical wound. It could take a picture and analyze that and send it back to your surgeon or someone who might be bedbound and have an ulcer. So we can start to scale and measure these things and send them digitally to help do smarter intervention.
All under the umbrella of don't come in.
Right, especially if you're infectious.
Exactly, yeah.
There have been other ones that can you can spit in a cup and it will measure on a sort of similar approach to the urinalysis whether you might have a respiratory tract infection like the flu. And so these technologies will impact public health and hopefully bring us better care at lower costs. Another more extreme example of a true selfie, I train in pediatrics, and we might see a young child which might have a genetic disorder. There's some classic facial features, for example, for a child with Down syndrome with trisomy 21, which is a very most common genetic disorder. And a good pediatrician can recognize that, but there's hundreds or thousands of other genetic disorders that are hard to figure out. Well, there's a company that's used artificial intelligence and machine learning called Face to Gene, where they literally take a picture of the child's face. Now compare that to a database of thousands of known genetically identified children, and now can correlate what genetic disorder do they have and what genetic change do they have specifically. So it's going to hopefully speed up the way that we can identify a genetic problem and then intervene early without even doing a full-on genetic analysis.
I have to say that this ability to intervene early is absolutely key in so many things. We know that if we have a diseased organ or diseased tissue, but in many cases, for instance, in autism, we frequently don't diagnose fully until age 4. And there are some new genetic testing that is going on that can roll that back potentially to a year and a half. It means you can intervene early.
And not only intervene early, but start to find different subtypes. There's another sort of medical selfie or medical video camera called Cocoon Cam, which uses just the video of a child sleeping in their crib. Now with certain software and AI can pick up the heart rate and the respiratory rate. Now also start to measure motion and listen to cry. And my hypothesis is as we crowdsource that data, we can start to identify children with autism at maybe 3 months of age and intervene even earlier. So we'll start to use these sorts of ubiquitous sensing technologies in powerful ways. I'll give you two more examples of a medical selfie that really go even medically inside. The idea of a home ultrasound. Imagine having a pocket ultrasound. And, you know, it usually takes years of training, an ultrasonographer, you know, a medical license even. They're now coming onto the market, launched in early 2019, a company called Butterfly has a basically consumer-level ultrasound, which has artificial intelligence sort of empowering it. So an exam can be done by almost anybody, helps guide where you'd put that to look at your heart or at your kidneys. This is particularly useful in the developing world where there's not a lot of high-tech, expensive ultrasound. So we're really starting to spread these technologies to your own home and pocket to look really inside, the true inside selfie, all the way to emerging markets where a nurse practitioner or a midwife could do a better job of identifying a problem and correcting it. The idea of a selfie goes beyond just, you know, physical features. You can even look at measures that are in your blood or literally your blood level. Published earlier this year was an approach where you can take a picture of your fingernails and it would be within about 5%, let's say, or 1% of your actual hemoglobin level identified by the color of your fingernails. So literally another screening approach for folks who might have a risk of anemia or low blood levels can be detected with your smartphone camera and an app. Still in the academic space today, but maybe an important screening way to do your own medical selfie or medical fingernail picture in the future.
Well, what do they think of bubblegum pink? I'm just asking here. You're the doc, you know.
We'll always have. There's always going to be confounding variables. You know, but part of this trend of the medical selfie or the home ultrasound or even companies with a pocket stethoscope called the Echo, also powered by AI that not only listens to your heart sounds but also does an EKG at the same time, is that we'll be more empowered to do triage, pick up our own problems in the safety and privacy of our own homes, and then hopefully get the full-on medical attention we need early or be reassured that we're doing okay.
Well, everybody can't have my plan, which is see you every so often. Say, what do you think? How am I doing?
Not your doc in the pocket, but the doc in the studio.
Doc in the studio, and everybody else has got to rely on this tech. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Mara.
TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. The Exponential Medicine Conference 2019 is scheduled for early November at the Hotel Coronado in San Diego. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.